Hi everybody, Steve Savitsky, and today we have Mr. Sam Finkel. Sam is a resident of Yerushalayim and a very interesting book he's written. We're going to talk a little bit about it. Sam, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Well, that's really good, and I know that in the fall edition of Jewish Action 2013, they will be reviewing your book, which is called Rebels in the Holy Land, Maskeret Batya, an early battleground for the soul of Israel. Big book, 460 pages, so it's a lot of reading, but I heard it's really fascinating, and it's really a historical novel in a way, isn't it?
You can say that. It's a popular history as opposed to a scholarly type of reading.
So what's the difference between the two?
Scholarly book is more of original research and goes into a lot of technical issues. And this book is based on technical research and scholarly research, but it is basically adapted for the average reader so that they can enjoy the book without having to go into all the various intricacies of the issues that are brought up.
Okay, good. That's interesting. And I understand there are quite a bit of footnotes, 521 footnotes to be exact, and 435 photographs and illustrations. Let's talk a little bit about the period of history. So, I mean, this is now, we go back to about 1880, 81, and we go to Russia, and with a group of Jews who live there who decide that they want to go to Israel and start an agricultural community, correct?
Yes. We're talking about what's called the first Aliyah period, which spans from 1882 to 1904. And it's just an arbitrary name because there were Aliyot before that. The old Yishuv, the students of the Gaon of Vilna and the disciples of the Baal Shem Tov, they came earlier. The modern historians decided to call this period the first Aliyah period because it was the first time that Jews are coming to build agricultural self-sustaining communities, which they felt was like the basis for eventually what would lead to the modern state of Israel. So that's why it was called the first Aliyah period.
Okay. And how many people actually came? I mean, I know this is a small group. So how many people actually came in totality?
Several thousand. Several thousand people came during this period. And about a dozen settlements were set up throughout the country. Most of them were funded by Baron Edmund de Rothschild, but there was only one settlement was funded by the Chov Beit Sion, which is like the precursor to the Zionist movement.
The group we're talking about was funded by Baron Rothschild. I mean, that's pretty apparent. Were the other groups also more religious, or were they more secular?
Maskeret Batya was probably the most traditional Orthodox of all the various settlements that were set up, but it wasn't so outstandingly different. In other words, the vast majority of the settlers of these settlements were Orthodox Jews of various shades. Rishon LeZion was probably the most modern and most lax of the in terms of Orthodoxy. But even Rishon LeZion, when they first came to the sand dunes over there, and they stopped and they davened mincha. I mean, that's we have a record of that. There were other settlements which were much more traditional. You have Gay Oni, which later became Moshe Pina. You have Zichron Yaakov. There's a place called Bnei Yehuda. There was founded by very Orthodox Jews. Yehud Amala was founded by very, very Orthodox Jews. So there's a general impression people normally associate the pioneers with the second Aliyah, and they think of Degania as a prototype of these, the first pioneers, and these are secular type of people, and it's not true. The first pioneers were Orthodox, by and large.
Really, that really is a revelation, because most people don't know that. So this group goes and they decide they want to do this. Obviously, they need the funding, and this is where Baron Edmund de Rothschild comes about, and he agrees to fund them and to help them establish.
If I can interrupt you a
second, please,
not exactly like that.
Okay.
I don't know if you remember, I don't know how old you are, Mr. Savitsky, but I remember as a child there used to be a television show called The Millionaire.
Yes, I remember. Someone comes, knocks on your door and drops, all of a sudden drops off a check, right?
Exactly. And there's this one fellow who gives out this money. Now, we're talking about a very small, isolated... I mean, I just came from Lithuania. I was in Lithuania last week. And I actually visited this tiny little village, but what I was writing about. I wanted to see it for myself. We're talking about small, tiny little communities that are spread out through Lithuania. And outside one of these small communities, Lojnoi, was a tiny little farming colony called Pavlovka, or Pavlovo in Russian. And these are Jews who were basically working the land, and all of a sudden, one day, three people show up. One of them was the rabbi of nearby Lojnoi. It was Rabbi Mordechai Gipel Yaffe. People who learn Ramban and Chumash have heard his commentary, Tchelis Mordechai. And there was another Macher from the town, and there was a fellow by the name of Yechiel Bill, who was an emissary of Rabbi Shmuel Mulliver. And Rabbi Shmuel Mulliver was acting on behalf of Baron Edmund de Rothschild. And all of a sudden, they are presented, these farmers, who had no association with any kind of colonization organization. They had nothing to do with Chovetzion. Mm-hmm. We're suddenly presented with a proposal. Would you be interested in taking part in an experiment of going to Eretz Yisrael, colonize the land, and create an experimental farming colony, and you will be like a banner, and you lead the way, will you trailblaze this for other Russian Jews to follow? And these guys, out of nowhere, they have these people coming to them. And they have like a few days to make a decision. And they decide in the end that they are going to do it. And that's what's so amazing about it. Because unlike all the other settlements at that time, this was the only settlement in which the founding fathers had nothing to do with any kind of colonization organization or a Zionist organization. Uh-huh.
Interesting. So, okay, so they go ahead and there are 11 men who, you know, basically were picked to be, you know, the representatives of the town, so to speak. And
there were 10 who were picked, and one was a stowaway.
one was a stowaway. That's interesting. How do you stow away in those days?
Well, what happens is that they were supposed to be 10 men who were supposed to meet Yechiel Bill, who escorted them to Palestine at a train station at 4 o'clock in the morning, and all of a sudden he sees an 11th fellow. And the others insisted that he come along. He would be an insurance as a minion man, just in case one of them gets sick, mm-hmm. they'll for sure have a minion.
Right, okay. So, and it's interesting, I thought, was that the way the land was purchased, it really, really reminded me of today when I hear about what goes on with Ateret Kohanim, how sometimes they purchase land. It really was really the same thing. It was done not outright. It was done through Paris and a charity, and then it had to be approved by the Ottoman authorities and then eventually transferred to Rothschild, right? It was a little circuitous way.
Correct. It was not easy because the Ottomans were very wary of any kind of intrusions into their empire. They were in a weakened state at this period of time, and they certainly, after a war with Russia that occurred a few years earlier, they weren't interested in having Russian citizens, even if they were Jewish, starting to make colonies in their country.
Right. So, but the people who went, I mean, their motivation was really just Yeshiva Aretz, was to be the mitzvah of living in the land. I mean, it wasn't a Zionistic dream. It was more of a, you know, this is the place we belong. Is that right?
I would say so. We don't know for sure what they were thinking, but they certainly had a very strong religious basis for it, because when the Shemitah issue came up in 1880...
Right, we're going to get to that, obviously, sure.
Right. They were adamant about doing it, so obviously the religious element was very, very strong for them.
Right. Okay, so they weren't saying a bracha for the Medina at that point, right?
No, they weren't thinking in terms of nationalism.
Right.
No.
But, you know, here's the thing also that I'm trying to understand. It seemed that, you know, the Baron was more sympathetic towards them, appreciated what they were doing, and yet the people he appointed to supervise didn't seem to represent his views. So how did that happen?
Rothschild, that was an era when there was a lot of elitism, when the Western Jews had a very patronizing, condescending attitude towards the Eastern Jews. They felt that they had a moral obligation to help them, and they were very, very generous. But there was also a feeling of, I know better than you. Mm-hmm. I know better than you what's good for you. And Rothschild, no one's ever done this before. Rothschild picked administrators who he felt fit the bill, but he didn't realize that under his very nose, they were trying to undermine some of the spiritual elements of these colonies that he was funding. He didn't realize what these guys were up to. They're shenanigans, I think.
And the people that he appointed, these were people who actually lived already in Israel or not? Well, they moved there.
No, they moved there. There was one who was very involved, who was already living there. That was Shmuel Hirsch, who was the director of the Mikveh Israel Agricultural School. Mm-hmm. But the others may have lived in the Middle East and other countries, and they were brought in to administer the colonies.
Right, because you talk about this one fellow, Bloch, who was appointed, and the problems that ensued between the people in the community. Also, I just want to get back to one other thing that people maybe want to know, that in other words, it's called Maskeret Batya in matching memory of the Baron's mother, correct?
Correct, yes. Yeah.
Which is really, really interesting about that. And then comes, you know, they're struggling and things are really tough. I mean, you read about the conditions, the terrible conditions of malaria. It was really quite something. And then we deal with the Shemitah issue, which was, a really focal point in the disagreement between different Rabbanim in Europe. And so let's talk about that, because that's a whole chapter unto itself. So what happened?
So the Shemitah year was approaching. First of all, I have to understand that Hove Tzion was a very novel experiment. It was the first time in Eastern European Jewish history where you had secular and religious Jews working together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a major controversy in the Orthodox community. Is such a thing actually viable? There were many Orthodox Jews and rabbis who said this was not a good idea, that it could only lead to problems. There were others like the Nativ who said, no, this is a wonderful opportunity to bridge the gap between the secular and the religious, that was widening and widening, and now suddenly anti-Semitism is bringing us together, and let colonization of Eretz Yisrael bring us together even more so. Now, with the Shemitah controversy, you have here a situation where the secular within the Hove Tzion saw Shemitah as an absolute catastrophe, something which would be absolutely totally detrimental and destructive to the colonization enterprise. And they, in turn, the more radical Maskilim, put pressure on the more traditional Maskilim, and they, in turn, put pressure on the Rabbanim of Hove Tzion. And so there was like a domino effect. Eventually, this led to Rabbi Shmuel Mulliver coming out with his own Hetzer Mechira, along with two other rabbis. And then once he came out, these three rabbis came out with their Hetzer Mechira. Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector, who was very reluctant to come out publicly with the Hetzer Mechira, even though he was asked to by Rothschild, or by Rav Tzadok Kahn, Rothschild's rabbi, he came out with the Hetzer Mechira. So to the more right-wing Orthodox rabbis, they say, yeah, you see what's going on over here? The secular are influencing the Zionistic rabbis in terms of religion. Does this sound familiar, like what's going on today?
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds exactly what's happening today in Israel.
Exactly. And so this was going on even before the Zionist movement began. This was going on already with the Chovei Tzion. And the pressure that was put on the... So that's basically what was going on. Now the Heter Rechila was very vague, and they never got a signed copy of the Heter Rechila. When the Heter Rechila was sent to them, there was nobody who was officially representing Rabbi Spector or Rabbi Molitor who would instruct them exactly what to do. And these farmers from Maskerabachi were very, very religious people, very God-fearing people. And the one thing that was most important to them, despite all the difficulties and hardships that had occurred to them, was they did not want to violate God's will, which has always amazed me. Because, you know, I mean, when people were firm in those days, they were very, very firm.
Right.
So... Yeah. So they had, on the other hand, they had the rabbis in Yerushalayim who were completely opposed to the Heter, and it was very clear exactly what they could not do, and they also made it very clear what they could do in terms of vineyards and so forth, but these farmers were wheat farmers, and they basically made it very clear to them, you cannot farm the land this year, you cannot do anything with regards to the land this year. And they followed that. So now with Rothschild, who was not Orthodox, he was sympathetic to Orthodoxy, but he wasn't Orthodox, and his anti-religious administrators putting tremendous pressure on the farmers to violate their religious standards. This was a signal to the Orthodox, the right-wing Orthodox, who felt that working with the secular was not a good idea. To them, this was a very clear evidence that this whole Chovei Tzion experiment was a bad idea. Mm-hmm. And the Shemitah, if anything, created a cleavage within the Orthodox community between those rabbis who were going to be eventually become anti-Zionist and those who were going to be pro-Zionist. The Shemitah issue was like a watershed event.
So in this particular, setting, what actually happened? Did they just leave the land barren, or did they sell it? Did they have the Heter Mechira or not?
The farmers of Maskerabacha left the land barren. There was throughout the colonies that were under Rothschild's command, there were rebellions going on all the time, and every single rebellion against Rothschild was crushed with an iron fist. However, this was the only rebellion that I know of that they actually succeeded.
Really?
They don't nearly starve to death, but the Rothschild's administrators were not able to break them.
So this was in 1888, is that right?
Pardon?
This is in 1888, correct?
Yeah, 1888, 1889.
Right. So they observed Shemitah completely.
1889, 1890.
Okay.
Tafresh
Memtet. Okay, so they observed Shemitah completely. And
yeah.
did the bracha of the Torah come true or not?
Not at all.
Not at all. Oh, boy.
Not
all. All right. It doesn't have a happy ending. Okay.
Not only did the bracha not come true, but those people who relied on the Heter Mechira, and the Heter Mechira was very much abused because the Heter Mechira is limited. Okay. It does not allow... The Heter Mechira of Rabbi Spector and even Rabbi Molitor did not allow plowing and seeding and so forth and so on. Okay,
right.
So the Heter Mechira was abused by that. But those people who followed the Heter Mechira and even those people who abused Heter Mechira, they had an unusually good rainfall that year.
Oh, really?
And they had a bumper crop. And
really?
Eliezer Ben Yehuda, who was the most vociferous opponent.
Right.
To strict Shemitah observance, he said, "You see, I told you all along that this was the right way to go."
So the proof that the Heter Mechira was correct was the fact that it was rainfall was plentiful and they were able to have a bumper crop, and okay, that's good. Okay, That's everybody listening. You got to hear that. That shows that there's something to it. And
what really? It doesn't prove that it's okay.
No, I'm just because, you know, listen. But the thing is this: what actually happened though? I mean, I know there were two things that were interesting. I mean, unfortunate, which was that the city that they all lived in, where they came from, which was Pavlovka, in 1942, all those people were murdered by the Nazis.
Yeah.
And the place itself, what happened to it? Is it still there? Or what happened?
I just came from there. I was there.
No, I'm talking about in Israel. I'm talking about in Israel now. You know what happened?
Oh, what happened to Basker Batya?
Yeah.
Basker Batya is now a town of 11,000 people. I would say maybe 20% are I guess what you call modern Orthodox. And the rest are varying degrees of traditional and secular. So it's basically a mixed town, but it's mostly a secular town right now.
And is it still called the same name, Basker Batya?
Yes.
Oh, it is. Okay. Interesting. And there's still agriculture or not?
There is still agriculture there. Not much, but there's still agriculture, and there are still farmers who are descendants of the original founders who are farming the land there.
Amazing. Listen, it sounds like a really, really fabulous book and interesting. I mean, from both two approaches. One, you could read it almost as a story, and you could really start to do the research and look at the footnotes. And we're looking forward to people really responding to this. And we're delighted that we were able to review it by Toby Klein Greenwald in the Jewish Action, and encourage people to get the book and to read it. It's called Rebels in the Holy Land, Maskeret Batya, An Early Battleground for the Soul of Israel, by Sam Finkel. Sam, thank you so much for coming on the program. I really enjoyed it. Be well. Bye-bye.
Thank you. All the best.